is drawing very nigh. Let's creep away from the day and allow me to say goodbye.
Hey, this is Betsy Ellis. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And thanks for tuning into Art Speak Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Mark Manning. Today I'm filling in as host and producer for your regular host and producer, my friend Maria Vasquez Boyd, who is away on a literary adventure in Minnesota. Today on Art Speak Radio, we'll talk with Lisa Cordes, Professional Development Program Director for Artist Inc., a collaborative partnership that connects Kansas City artists to all disciplines, to the tools, resources of all disciplines, to the tools, resources, and opportunities necessary to develop their skills, strengthen their artistic practice. Joining Lisa in the conversation is Anson the Ornery and Camry Ivory, two of the artists selected for the 2015 Artist Inc. Live Seminar, an 8-week session that began on March 2nd. And at 12:30 in our second hour of the broadcast, we're going to be talking with Erinisa Rabish, co-director of the new documentary film Shoulder the Lion, and Katie Dellum, a painter and sculptor from Kansas City, who is the inspiration for the Academy Award-winning film Million Dollar Baby, who is also one of three artists featured in this very special documentary. Shoulder the Lion is part of the Middle of the Mount Film Fest at Alamo Drafthouse. That film fest starts today, runs through Sunday, April 12th. Shoulder the Lion will have two screenings, Friday, April 10th at 8:15 and Saturday, April 11th at 3:30. We're also going to be featuring new music from Mikhail Shapiro from her new recording, The Musical. Please stay tuned. All right, welcome to Art Speak Radio. Originally launched in 2007 as KC Artist Link, Artist Inc. connects Kansas City artists to, of all disciplines, to all kinds of tools that help them and strengthen them. Lisa Cordes is the Professional Development Program Director for Artist Inc. She's been a member of the Kansas City arts community for more than 25 years, working as an artist, administrator, and educator. For the past decade, she's served in administrative leadership positions at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, Mid-America Arts Alliance, Kansas City Friends of Elvin Ailey, and Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. Lisa Cordes, thank you for being with us on Art Speak Radio.
It's really great to be here.
Welcome back to the radio. We're happy
to
have you.
It's great to be here. Back on Art Speak, although I will get confused because I'm used to talking to you on your other show.
Yes, right. It's kind of confusing. This show's kind of a spin-off of Wednesday Midday Medley. We're really proud to have this program on the air and in its new time slot here at noon. So Artist Inc. workshops are now in their 7th year. That's right. And you've had over 300 artists go through this.
We're up to about 350 artists in the Kansas City community. But now we are not just in Kansas City anymore. We are actually out in the region. So we have had another 144 artists served in Omaha, Oklahoma City, Argenta, Arkansas, which is North Little Rock, and Austin, Texas. And we're going to welcome two new communities. We're not ready to announce those, but two new communities in the spring of 2016. So the network of artists and the Artist Inc. Fellows family is gone beyond Kansas City, which is actually really good for Kansas City artists also. Right now we're trying to figure out how we're going to keep all these folks connected and learning how to meet each other and share resources in a regional capacity.
How did the program get launched? And can you talk about how those artists who've completed the seminars have become mentors and encouraged their artist friends to also be involved in this?
Well, just really quickly, it sort of came out of organization called LINC, Leveraging Investments in Creative Communities, which actually doesn't exist anymore. There was some national funding from Rockefeller Foundation, some other big sort of East Coast arts funders, and they went around and looked at communities around the country to determine what individual artists in each community needed. So it was really about what the community was wanting. So it started with several iterations of the Creative Capital from the Warhol Foundation, Creative Capital Workshops. And the demand for them was so great. I was on the panel the first year of Creative Capital, and I think we had over 80 applications for 25 slots. So the artist demand was really great. David Hughes, who was at Charlotte Street Foundation at that time, and Paul Tyler from the Arts KC were really instrumental in getting that. Then they brought in the UMKC Innovation Center, and so they got involved. And a woman, you know, everything sort of happens with a little bit of serendipity. And there was a woman at the Innovation Center named Diane Scott, who had this great history and career in training businesses and small businesses, but also had been a theater major and knew artists and understood what was particular about them and how the training should and could be tooled to serve artists in their careers and helping them grow their businesses, create sustainable careers, and strengthen their art practice. So it was born, like I said, and it continues to be a partnership. And then a couple years ago, welcomed Mid-America Arts Alliance into the partnership. So the core activity is the 8-week seminar. And that's the one where we've reached 350 artists. But we also do events, workshops, speaker events. And we also have an online version, which Anson just told me the other night, is nothing like Artist Inc. Because really, Artist Inc., the seminar gives a lot of information, but it's really about growing and connecting a community of artists who, over time, share information. So the whole program is artist-facilitated and artist-driven, and that's actually what makes it distinctive amongst other programs.
You brought with you two of the artists who have been selected for the 2015 Artist Inc. live seminar, the session that actually began March 2nd. Would you introduce the people that you brought?
They're hip deep. they're deep in now. There's no turning back. We just got done with our spring break. We have a week off in between. So, Camry Ivory and Anson the Ornery. So I'm going to let them talk about themselves.
Camry Ivory is an emerging singer-songwriter here in Kansas City who's been on this radio show, on the Wednesday Midi Medley show several times. And you were the winner of the 2012 Young Bloods Songwriter Contest. And you perform in several bands, including Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds, Found a Job, Anna Cole and the Other Lovers, and the KC Latin Jazz All-Stars.
Yes.
Hi, Camry.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Welcome back to the radio.
Thank you.
Also, Anson the Ornery. Am I saying that better?
Well, Anson the Ornery.
Ornery. Thank you. I keep mispronouncing a word that I shouldn't be mispronouncing. And you're a multimedia artist who likes to work in music, visual arts, and writing, and acting, and performing.
Yeah.
You kind of do it all, don't you?
I do whatever I want.
And you received your BFA in expanded media from the University of Kansas in 2010 and minors in music and English. And then you moved to Kansas City to kind of pursue your career as an artist here to get going.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's more opportunities. I mean, just being in a bigger city, there's just also just career-wise opportunities more in art handling and museums and things like that, that you can actually work in the art world.
We're going to play a little bit of some of the music that you've made a few years back that's available on your Bandcamp page. But anyway, welcome to the show. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to be a part of Artist Inc.?
I think, you know, when you're wanting to do it professionally and you're starting to get to that point in your career, you hit a point in your career where you know what you want to say. And I think it takes a little bit, especially when you get out of college. I think that's the main thing, is you've been told what to make for so long, or at least you have a framework. And so I think once you finally find your voice and you know what you want to say and you know who you are, trying to then make money off of it and make it a living, I think that's what this program's for. I mean, even if it's not your sole income, it at least teaches you how to be professional and make somewhat of a living, or at least another income stream, to at least not make it a financial strain on your life. and rather something you can actually draw more income from.
Kimberly, how about you? What drew you to the program?
Sure. Well, I had a lot of friends who had done the program, and they encouraged me to apply. And I was nervous. I was hesitant about doing it just because I wasn't really sure about who I was as an artist and as a musician. But what I really love about this program is that it encourages you to explore different assets or aspects of your artistic personality and explore some future potential projects that you could potentially do in the future. And really collaborating with other artists from different disciplines is probably the best part of this program.
That is a really cool part of the program, the fact that you have people who specialize in visual arts, people that specialize in music, a lot of music mm-hmm. people, and then those performing artists that create performing works that involve other people that they're producing. I know, Anson, you kind of do all of that, don't you? Mm-hmm. So you kind of fit in. But Lisa, it's kind of an interesting mixture of these different disciplines, different
people. It's by design. The program, first of all, I should let people know it's a competitive program. So there's an application process. We started back in October. So they have to apply. The panel that we select, that representative of leading artists and heads of arts organizations in the community, we ask them to look at the quality of the work, because Anson, I think, expressed it really well. This program works if you know who you are as an artist and have a voice and have a body of work. We have a separate collegiate program, which sort of focuses on artists just recently graduated. But the program is really about emerging and mid-career artists who, like I said, know their voice. So we look at their artwork, but we also we ask them questions about what their career and their goals and what they want out of it. We call it readiness, and it's a little hard to define, but we have found the people that do the best in the program are, like I said, people who found their voice, have a body of work, and just feel like they're not getting any traction in their careers. I think a lot about intentional careers. Artists, if you're not careful, can be rather like a little boat that just goes from wave to wave, and you're not really plotting your own course.
Gets flushed around a little bit.
Right, and you don't necessarily have a direction. So one of the biggest things we teach is goal setting and strategic goal setting about what you want, and short term and long term. And it's really interesting because we have artists who still keep those goals that they, and we make them write them down, because there's all this study about the likelihood of you staying with a goal if you write it down is much, much higher. So we have artists that still have their goals up in their studio who still return to them. The program is also really based on, we do a lot of different styles of learning. For adult learners and for artists, it's all about, we share knowledge with them, but we also have mentoring and peer networks. So their small group that they're with during the 8 weeks becomes really important. We still have small groups that were in the initial seminar, a small group from 2009 that still meets on a, not a monthly basis, but several times a year, that Jose Faust facilitates, and he confirms that they still get together. So it, like I said, it creates this network out there that continues to provide that ongoing support. So it's not like Artist Inc. inoculates you from getting off course or...
Wouldn't that be nice?
and I think also the point Anson made, we're not really telling people, okay, after you're done, you can go quit your day job uh-huh. or you're going to make all this money. It's really not about that. It's about, what do you want your career to look like? Some people love their day job for various reasons, be it they like the work or they like the security. It's really about what you want it to be. And the other thing we know from research is that most artists that are successful have what we call portfolio careers, meaning they do not have one income stream. In fact, it's perilous to have one income stream, because if something happens to that stream and you don't have other things. So artists sell their work, but they also teach. They have just a variety of things. We have a number of artists that work for Artist Inc. on a regular basis as facilitators. So we encourage that because, like I said, it's more sustainable over time, and there's greater opportunities to be flexible, because if you've got one solid stream, then you can... I mean, we have artists that own property and get rental income, and that's one of their streams, which gives them a certain ability then to maybe change what they're doing creatively that maybe not be so market driven because they have these other sources of income. So it's really about finding your own path depending on what you want your life and career to look like.
I love it. Ants in the Ornery, how did you get your name? And when did you know you were an artist?
I got it well earned.
I earned it.
Yes. I was not a very good kid and maybe still aren't. But for me, I think, and this is why I'm a big proponent of education of the arts in public schools. But for me, you know, I kept getting encouraged by one teacher. You know, they said, oh, you're good at music or you're good at art or you're good at literature. And that's kind of, it just became something I was interested in, and it was what I wanted to do, and it was expressive. And for me, I think the most important thing is it allows me to propagate my beliefs in a way and bring those to other people in a more indirect way, if you will, or a receptive way.
Your statement on your own website talks about how ultimately you want your art to be fun, and you want the people that see your art to be part of the art. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. What do you mean?
So I do interactive installations. That's kind of like one of my areas that I like to do. So I had a show where people were encouraged to destroy my art. I had another piece after that where I put out 200 free paintings all over Kansas City, and then when you found them, it's on the back, it said, send me a picture of this hanging in your house. To this, you know, add this email address. And then recently I just showed at the Haw, and I had a piece called Hashtag Helpy, which was a piece that you're supposed to take selfies in front of, but you couldn't light up the object to take pictures in front of unless someone else was cranking this crank box that was too far away for you to crank it. Therefore, you had to have help. So for me, you know, my art's not completed until the viewer interacts with it, and that's what I love, is there's that unpredictableness, and I don't have control of that, and that's what I want in my work, is to always have that space of I have my hands off, it's not mine anymore.
How has Artist Inc. Maybe changed you or affected you in the time that you've been involved?
I think it makes it feel like it's more possible to do this, at least as not a debt to myself, or, you know, not just a money pit. And then I'm just doing this for myself. And I think the big one is it really teaches you, like, this is how you be a professional. This is how you be a business. And that's important, is, you know, I think there's a myth of the artist being kind of like Van Gogh and just airy and spacey. And really, that's, you know, it takes all types, even in the art community. And, you know, you look at some of the most successful people in art, even in the 20th century, and they're business people. You know, Picasso was a business person. Warhol was a business person. Mm-hmm. And I think this just teaches you how to run yourself like a business and see yourself that way rather than that, and not get taken advantage by other people who have more means than you.
It's kind of a fine line, too, the idea of business and art, and it's so important to think that way. And Camry, I know you have been working in the music community and singing and performing for a number of years now.
Yes.
And you're in, as we mentioned, about four different bands that you play with, all very different from each other. Mm-hmm. All of the bands that you play with, Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds is one of the newest bands that you're a part of. Chris, who was a part of the Gaslights and Atlantic Fade Out and Tiny Horse, and one of the founders of the Midwest Music Foundation, put together this new band, himself and three incredible women who back him up. I think he intentionally wanted that female energy in the band, didn't he?
Definitely. Yeah, he was looking for that because it's not something that you necessarily see. I feel that rock music tends to be male-dominated. Not that there aren't women there, but sometimes we are kind of in the background, and I think that the band is really, it's strengthened by our feminine presence, in a sense.
You also sing back up with Anna Cole and the Other Lovers.
Yes,
supporting her in a big band of musicians that are all some of the best in town. And then you're part of the Talking Heads tribute band, Found a Job, which just did a big show at Knuckleheads this past weekend.
We did, yeah.
A lot of fun. That's a great band. And then the Casey, the other band, what is it called?
Casey Latin Jazz All-Stars. We're sort of on hiatus for a while because we are all involved in different musical projects as well. But that was started by Pablo Sanhueza, who is a percussionist from Chile, who really wanted to blend, sort of revitalize the bicultural, the multicultural essence of jazz in Kansas City. So it's very collaborative and very, really fantastic.
And through all of this, you've also been going to school, haven't you?
Yes, I got my master's degree from UMKC in December of 2013, so I'm done. And now I have free reign to explore other projects, especially my solo acts, which I've sort of put on the back burner for a while.
Is Artist Inc. a way for you to take that off the back burner and start working on that? Is that why you're involved? How did you get involved with Artist Inc.?
It really was. It was a promise to myself. I applied, and I was hesitant that I'd be accepted just because I think we all have our own self-doubts and our own harsh critics. But I said, you know, if I am accepted, I think this is a sign that I really need to start taking my work seriously. I've been playing at open mic nights and playing an opening for people if they asked me to, but I wasn't actively promoting or exploring my own art. And I felt that a part of my artistic soul was sort of being neglected because of that. And so being an Artist Inc. helps me be, I don't want to say selfish, but really explore that personal side that's been neglected for a while.
Maybe, like, you need to be a little bit more selfish
yes,
right now,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, really nurture.
Because you're so giving as a performer to other people's, because all of these bands, you kind of are helping someone else with their dream, with
right.
their lyrics, their music, and to be a solo artist gives you a chance to work on your own vision.
It does. It's very scary, though, because you are in charge and you can make or break the project as a backup singer. You show up and you sing, and you don't have to worry about booking or, you know, networking or marketing. So this is a whole new avenue to explore.
Anson, you also are part of the music community, mm-hmm. especially in Lawrence. You do shows with Psychic Heat and a lot of the big bands in Lawrence all the time, don't you?
Well, that's kind of funny. I really never got shows in Lawrence until I moved here. So my hometown, but they weren't too friendly to me until I left. But I think, again, I was in school when I was there, and I didn't have as much projects. I play at Harling's a lot, and they're really kind to me. I'm having a show there on May 1st with Wolf the Rabbit and CX Luxem. So I don't play out too much yet. I'm trying to put an album together first, and then I do live visuals that I manipulate while I play. And so that's kind of a one-step, next-step kind of ordeal, but I do play out a little bit, about once a month.
It seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but there probably is some overlapping of it all, but it seems like you keep these different mediums sometimes separate from each other. Your yeah. music work is separate from your visual work sometimes. Is that true or not?
Well, I think it just took me a long time to figure out how to put them together. I mean, that's what I've wanted to do since probably high school, maybe before when I started doing all of them, you know, and I've know a lot about animation and things like that that I feel do put all those arts together. For me, my live music, that's what the video is. So I actually do all the video, and then I set it up so that the colors will change depending on what note I hit. Wow. I can change the position of where it is depending on like the drum pad and things like that. It all kind of stemmed out of when I first applied to grad school. I did a project called the Cineclavier, which the idea was to induce synesthesia in the viewer. Now, it didn't work, but again, that was my attempt to put visuals with oral, with literature, numbers, and things like that. And so it is all, I'm always thinking about it and how to do that and how to push mediums into those other things, but I think sometimes, you know, going straight to the source and going to a very pure form is also nice, you know, and it's unfortunately there's just more of a market for it. So, you know, I do straight watercolor paintings because there's a market for it rather than trying to do a multimedia interactive thing that's almost not sellable.
It's beautiful that there is an Artist Inc. and a Charlotte Street Foundation and all of these organizations that help them. And talk about the facilitators, Lisa, who are involved. Many of these are people like yourself who've actually gone through the program and come back to give back and to help with all of these people in this current class.
Well, the core of the program, the success of the program, we call it the secret sauce, is that it's artist facilitated. Because and I don't know, Anson and Camry may not have had this experience, but a lot of people do. There's a certain amount of pain to the process because a lot of these things are things artists have been avoiding for a long time, confronting, doing, writing an artist statement, creating a budget for your artwork and your art making, doing your taxes, setting goals, because then you're kind of holding yourself accountable. And that's the other thing. The facilitators help hold people accountable. But they also understand, and they've been there, and they have a huge amount of wealth of knowledge to share. So right now for the 2015, we have Aaron McGrain from Victor and Penny, and Bo Bledsoe, and Jose Faust, and Chris Dahlquist, and who am I forgetting? Larry Thomas, who runs the art department out at Johnson County Community College. That's horrible, because Larry has done more artist ink facilitating than anybody else. He's been with the program from the start. So they facilitate these small groups. They every session, they're running part of the program, facilitating discussions. And I should also mention that we bring in subject matter experts on topics. So Dean Vivian, Kansas City artist tax man, comes in and does a whole session on taxes, which always thrills. Seriously, he gives the most entertaining and informative talk on taxes. And we could give him the whole three-hour session and he could fill it. Don Simon comes in and talks about copyright and contracts and business formation. And it's so great because these are two people that have such a connection and to the community and to the arts community, and so they get it. And there's just a lot of extra stuff when they come in. We'll have Julia Cole that runs the Rocket Grants program come in next week to talk about grants. And so Margaret Keough, that was at the Kemper Museum and now Mid-America Excellence, talks about marketing. So we try to bring in lots of different resources while they're there, because that's part of the community too. It's not just your fellow artists struggling across from you at the table. It's like, okay, here's somebody you should know. Here's somebody who's going to help you. And then they're given all kinds of materials with additional resources. So it's really about empowering. So it's like, you can Google a lot of these things and get the information you need. We're there to give them big overview of how you craft your path. And then it's what the best education is. You make people want to learn more on their own.
I love it. Well, we only have a few seconds left, but I want to give you guys a final comment. Camry, why is it important to have this program, Artist Inc.?
I think it teaches you to take advantage of the resources that are available in Kansas City. We are so fortunate to live here. It's a wonderful collaborative environment, so it's great.
Thank you. Anson, what do you think?
Community. I think it really just continues to build that artist community here, and I think for any success of a movement, an artist movement, it's been the community and supporting each other.
Very much so. Lisa?
I want to do a little commercial. Yes. The final
session. It's a non-commercial
session,
radio station.
Session 8, which is the final session, they do presentations using the Pachakacha form. So they're 5-minute presentations, tops. And we'll have all 24 artists in the program this week. We're going to do it at the American Institute for Architects Space, AIA, down at 18th and 19th and McGee, 20th and McGee. This is a terrible commercial.
Well, we'll give the website so people
can go to that. Yeah, and we'll send out more information about that. But it's open and free to the public, and we really welcome people to come and learn about. We have a rock star class this session.
I'd say so, definitely. I definitely agree with that. I'm so excited about all of you. Congratulations for being accepted into the program, and keep us posted. And please come back on the radio show to share your art with our listening audience whenever you want to. We're here for you to do that. And Lisa mentioned you can go to artistinckc.com. People can sign up to get your Pushing the Flywheel.
Yeah, go to pushingtheflywheel.com, and we send out a weekly digest. This is where we post resources, opportunities, grant deadlines, all kinds of things. Every week we send a digest, and we have over 12,000 artists that visit every year Pushing the Flywheel, and then, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 that get the weekly digest. Sign up for that. It's great. It's an email people you'll actually want to open.
Yes. All right. www.artistinckc.com. Also, for more information about Anson, the Ornery. Mm-hmm. Am I saying that wrong still?
I think you got it that time.
Anson the Ornery.
Hard, Mark.
I know, I do that. AnsonTheOrnery.com and then CamryIvory.com are their respective websites where you can learn more about them. They'll be listing events and projects that you can see of their work. We're going to go out with some music from Ants in the Ornery. This is from a single you put out a couple years ago through your Bandcamp, Emulsion. Do you want to, we're only going to hear part of the song. Do you want to say anything about it before we push play?
It's been completely reworked, but it's for my next album, Furl, which is basically this song's about how even with documentation, nothing is can be for sure.
I love it. Alisa Cordes, Camry Ivory, Ants in the Ornery, thank you so much for being with us on Art Speak Radio.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
Training school in Ayotzinapa, Mexico, were attacked by police officers after protesting discriminatory hiring practices for teachers. In the next several hours, 6 students and teachers were shot dead, and 43 students were disappeared by police officers working with the drug cartel.
Sprouts takes a look at this through the wider lens of Mexican government corruption, Thursday at noon.
On the next Making Contact, reporter Daniel Grossman takes us to India in the heat of the moment. Sea level rise, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
On the next Bioneers.
Asked why, Cesar responded, "Because there is something even more important to farm workers than the benefits unionization brings. Because there is something more important to the farm workers' union than winning better wages and working conditions. That is protecting farm workers and consumers from systematic poisoning through the reckless use of agricultural toxins."
Friday morning, 9:30.
Tune in on Saturday afternoons for real local talk radio community programming. Starting at 3 o'clock p.m., Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell. 4 o'clock p.m., Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf. 5 o'clock p.m., Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with M.C. Richardson.
All right, you're listening to Art Speak Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Mark Manning, today filling in for your regular host, Maria Vasquez Boyd. Middle of the Mount Fest Film Fest begins today at Alamo Draft House at 1400 Main Street in the Power and Light District and runs through this Sunday, April 12th. The festival will feature over 25 films in 5 days, including the premiere of a new critically acclaimed documentary film called Shoulder the Lion, a film that examines the uncertainty of the future, seen through the experiences of three artists. Ellis Wingwall, a photographer who is blind, who questions the power of images in today's visually saturated culture. Graham Sharp, an Irish musician, plagued by hearing loss, who must give up his dream of playing music and reinvent a new future. And Kitty Dalham, a painter and sculptor, who searches for her place in life after a traumatic brain injury, scrambles her senses. The film is a unique film. It attempts to ask what it takes for someone to keep on going in times of uncertainty and uses this special form to produce the answers. Shoulder the Lion will have two screenings at the Middle of the Map Film Fest, Friday, April 10th at 8:15 p.m. and Saturday, April 11th at 3 o'clock p.m. Joining us today on ArtSpeak Radio is Erinisa Rumbish, who is the co-director of the film. Did I say your name correctly?
Yeah, pretty close.
I'm pretty close. She is the co-director of this new documentary film, Shoulder the Lion. And also with us is Kitty Dalham, who is a painter and sculptor from here in Kansas City, who is the inspiration for the Academy Award-winning film Million Dollar Baby, who is also one of the three artists featured in Shoulder the Lion. Thank you both for being with us on Art Speak Radio today.
Thank you, Mark.
So far, the film has played a number of film festivals this year, the Jameson Dublin International Film Festival, the Salem Film Fest, the Omaha Film Fest, and many others.
Yeah, we world premiered at Palm Springs International.
At Palm Springs International, and now you're playing here in Kansas City, which is kind of special because a part of the film was shot here in Kansas City, right?
Very special. Yes, it's a hometown for the film. A third of the film was shot in Kansas City and in the greater kind of rural area around Kansas City. Much of the film featuring Katie's story was shot at Stageport, which is here in the Crossroads District. Beautiful sound stage run by Tron Solo and really just amazing crews we worked with here and amazing locations. Some of, I think, the most kind of stunning, haunting exterior imagery we have in the film is from Kansas City.
The film is about three artists and we get to see their art and how they make their art. But each of these artists also become part of a larger art piece, as this documentary itself is a beautiful work of art. Can you share with us the process for creating the amazing visual pictures that are created for the film?
Yeah, absolutely. This was from the start. You know, I came to the table with Patrick with this idea. You know, these types of stories of people, of artists specifically, who have had something that has really changed their kind of their track in life, made them, you know, take a totally different turn. They've been forced physically or mentally to re-examine what they're doing and what they're about, and then, you know, forge forward in life. These stories had always really spoken to me, and Patrick said, all right, being an ex-painter, you know, it's almost something that doesn't interest me, but if I go and we tell these stories in this fashion where we are using images that are not the expected images that you would see and hear happening with what is being told to you in the film, if we can reach beyond that and we can find not the surface expression of it, but the meaning that is within, like what's really behind the circumstances that happen in our life. I think we can all look at our lives and say, oh, I was standing here and this occurred. But we also can know how when we were standing here and that occurred, that there was actually something that was tied to, that was maybe a deeper need that was within ourselves, a change that we needed to kind of get forced into place, or something that we needed to wake up to. And that's where it began, kind of like, okay, our wheels started to spin and get excited about
what would be the other way to both visually and auditorily represent the stories of these people's lives, so it's not just the illustration that we present in the film.
Ernessa, how did you meet Katie? How did that happen?
I actually, you know, I remembered when, as I said, these stories, they come into my life and they seem to stick very strongly in my memory. And as we were developing, you know, the idea for this film and then researching, I had remembered when Katie's story was very public at the release of Million Dollar Baby. She had, she was on Dateline. She had a cover story on the New York Times. So I just started to Google the archives of that to find her name. And then luckily she has a really great website that represents her story and her art. And I got her contact info through that. And luckily she got the message and she reached back. And then we kind of took it from there.
So many scenes in the movie touched me and caused me to become emotional while I was watching them. And one scene in particular that really actually made me start crying is a scene, Katie, where you're with your sister and you're inside a storage room or a garage going through stacks of your paintings and you're finding these panels and we're not sure what they are. And then slowly they're put together into this gigantic painting of these serpents and horses together. And it's just an emotional impact to see that image all together. And you kind of take the viewer through this process of being disorientated and kind of confused and not sure how it all connects. And then seeing it all together where it all just becomes clearer as to your vision. Can you talk about that particular scene in the film, Katie?
Yeah. My sister and I, well, she had taken me to a class, Paint or Die. And basically, it was you were given a piece of paper and told to put whatever you wanted to put down on it, but not have any preconceived ideas or pictures to look at or anything. And I really took to that. About a third of my brain was taken away by the brain injury, and what's left is on the side of my brain that has imagination, et cetera, et cetera. And what came through just came through. I had no idea what I was painting. And I had pieces of paper that I continually glued or taped together. And from one piece of paper to the next, I was continuing a serpent, and I was continuing a head of a horse, the body of a horse, but I had no idea what the outcome was going to be. I had no idea. And so what this mural came from was me just taping one piece of paper to another, and I had no idea how it was going to all look like. I had no idea what I was putting together. And my sister put all these pieces of paper together, and out of it came literally a perfect combination.
It's beautiful. Another scene in the film that I have to talk about that really touched me is you're walking through tall grass and with a large walking stick, and you pick up a large wooden ladder from the tall grass and raise it up into kind of a 45-degree angle towards the blue sky, and then you use your walking stick to support that ladder standing up by itself, and then step back and look at that. That is one of those examples where this film in itself is a piece of artwork. And it's another, you mentioned that Patrick, your husband, is a painter, and this film has so much art imagery and poetic imagery in it. It's very, very beautiful.
Yeah, a lot, you know, back to sort of the process of how we made the film, when we would initially kind of speak with Katie, we would hear her tell the story, and from that, we would get kind of the morsels of ideas that would start the wheels spinning of visuals that could be made to express this in the more interpretive and I hate to say abstract, because sometimes that feels like, oh, you know, it's abstract, so therefore we can't understand it. But, you know, the thing when you're working with abstract or you're working with poetics, it's very important that as long as you know what you're saying with that, it becomes an experience that it might not be so important that we're communicating exactly the same idea that comes in my brain that will come in yours, Mark, you know, or that would come in any other audience members, or that was necessarily the complete exact experience that Katie had, but that there's something that is universally understood within it. And so we would go through, we would hear these stories, we would then plan out a bunch of images through an image bank. We would come back to shoot with Katie, and then we'd have these mood boards, essentially, and we'd show her the ideas, and basically, especially Katie and her sister Stephanie, they would just like go off with us on brainstorming ideas and throwing new things in the pot. And so it was really very collaborative. They would get excited about how we were going to go. And, you know, something like that ladder sequence, that's what I call it, that you bring up with Katie in the field. I mean, that for Patrick and I is something that speaks to the kind of suicidal stage that Katie went through, you know, and it's that point where it's like, should I stay or should I go? And, but you know, it might have resonated differently with you, and that would be fine. I think there's just something really strong in the sequence of it.
Katie, we talked about you being the inspiration for the film Million Dollar Baby after this boxing match where you took 140 blows to your head. And can you tell me, how did that happen? How did they let you get hit that many times? This was the only boxing match you ever were a part of, right? It was your first.
It was my first professional bout. I was in, first I took kickboxing and then I took boxing, but, and I had boxed with guys and stuff like that. Just not professionally, but this was my first professional fight. I had seen women box professionally, you know, in their first fights or whatever, and nobody really got hurt. And I thought, stupidly, that would be a good way to make a few dollars or whatever. In my situation, it was more of somebody was... The fight itself was not treated as men fights were. The same rules weren't followed, and my nose was broken during the fight, and they didn't stop the fight to see if I was able to perform, breathe, or whatever. I don't remember the fight. My sister was there, so she told me all these things. I never fell down, which is my stubbornness, I suppose. And all I know is my sister came up after the fight and said that she was trying to get an ambulance there because I had stopped breathing properly. I was going into what she calls the death rattle. I'm sorry, I kind of forget.
That's okay. No, you're doing great. That's some of the most difficult parts of the film to watch, mm-hmm. And we have to see that to know the story. And in the film, you talk about how, after all of this happened to you, it was your anger that motivated you to go on. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was so angry. I don't think it's talked about in the film, probably not, because I don't remember. But I had, better for lack of better words, already left my body and zoomed up to the whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
But and my mother, who was already dead, was there, and I was glad to see her. But she told me I had to come back down, that there were things yet to be done on this planet, and I really didn't want to be here in that body, which was all beaten up, and the loss of blood was so great that my sister, you know, later informed me that I wouldn't really be alive, that I'd be sort of, whatever you call it, dead in my head. And at any rate, the bottom line is that nobody expected me to live through the surgery, because my blood had been so... so much blood had come out that when they took the part of my skull off, that it hit the ceiling. And there was so much blood loss that if I did live through surgery, which they didn't expect, that I would be as a vegetable. And so no one expected me to come back to be able to care for myself at all, much less walk or talk or anything. And I was angry about being back down here. I was angry about having lost so much. My memory was just terrible. And I had to relearn everything from walking and talking to anything else. And but my anger kept me alive. It kept me going. You know, if my attitude was this anger at God for bringing me back, and it was kind of an attitude like, okay, if that didn't take me, you know, up to you, then this won't take me. And I kind of, you know, kind of pushed the boundaries a little bit. But that kept me going.
One of the things that came through to me as someone watching the film is how strong you are as a person, your spirit and your mental capacities and also your physical strength. There's so many scenes of you holding big things and working in your art and your sculpture, and your art really changed. After this injury, your art became different, didn't it?
Yes.
You talk about in the film about how after the head injury, there was no middle ground. You talk about it as mud flaps are gone,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you basically are just stepping out of the way and letting the art pass through you.
Yeah. And there's no way to make something look pretty that's not pretty. You know, just it comes through however it is.
Erinisa, this is your first film as a director, right?
You've done
a lot of work in television, a lot of work in reality television.
Yeah.
This is, in a way, it's not reality television, but it's reality television kind of uses the documentary thing to tell their stories.
And as an editor, that's my career has been as an editor. And for Patrick, his career has been as a cinematographer. He has directed maybe some, he's directed some short films and music videos and commercials and such. But for both of us, it is our first feature film. And I have edited some feature documentaries, but yes, this is very different.
This is unlike any documentary that you're normally going to see, Katie. In most documentaries, there's the standard camera shot at you while someone off camera is asking questions and they're capturing your answers to those questions. But in this film, they asked you to also work as an actress mm-hmm. in the soundstage. There's one particular scene where you're on the floor of the soundstage with special lighting and you're kind of reaching out and there's close-ups of your hands. What was it like going beyond just the interview process to also being an actress, playing yourself, but in these amazing, beautiful scenes? She's laughing about it.
Well, because... Because
they use you a lot in those scenes in this film. It's beautiful.
Well, it was... Erinisa laughed at me because... with me. I don't know which way you want to look at it. But because I could concentrate and just do what she asked, because I don't have... I guess I have a lot of concentration in one area. I don't have all the different areas going at once at you because I have lost part of my brain. So it's just, if you were to tell me to sit and look at that for however long, that's what I would do. And it kind of made me easy to work with. So when she wanted me to lay on the ground and do whatever, then that's what I did. And it became real to me. You know, it was easy for me to become, because a part of me may still be laying on the ground wanting to, I don't know, go in, almost a sign of depression or something like that, wanting to crawl out. And I could become that part, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. And we believe you, which as an audience member, that's what you want to do in theater and performance. I'm with you every second of those moments. We need to mention that this also features two other amazing artists, a photographer who in 2000 lost her vision completely, and a musician who loses his hearing. And all of these musicians, artists, performers, photographers are kind of facing, where do we go next with our lives? It seems like one of the things that happened with these injuries is it changed how you do look into the future. Things change. It's more day by day. Is that your experience, Katie?
Yeah, it is. And I want to say that if I start looking into the future, I can become very depressed because I don't know what the future brings. And I have to keep in today just to, I don't know, just to stay aboard, above board, because I don't know what my future is. It's kind of a weird situation for me because I do lack part of my brain, and I don't have the faculties that I did. You know, I had a master's degree, and I worked with addicted people and stuff like that, and I don't have that anymore. And so if I think about the future, I start to get depressed, and I don't want to do that anymore.
In the film, we get to see a new piece of sculpture that you're creating out of metal and old tire parts, and you're twisting them, and we get again see your strength in putting this piece together. And this was commissioned for you to create by the Jewish Community Center?
No, the Johnson County Community College.
The Johnson County Community College. I'm sorry. I got my acronyms mixed up there. And this is going to, there's going to be an unveiling of this work, right?
Yeah. Starting on the 10th and running until May 15th, Katie has an exhibition at the Johnson County Community College. And the horse, did you ever name the horse? Does it have an official name? It was Thor 2 when you were making
it. Well, it was Thor 2 when I was making it. But no, not yet.
So they have now made the formal pedestal that it will live on the campus soon. But for the next month, it gets its first initial public unveiling. So this is really exciting. And the exhibition will also have many of Katie's drawings and paintings. So it'll be sculpture, painting, drawing. You really see a multi-discipline.
Yeah, it's up there on the third floor of the
student center
at
Johnson County Community College.
We have very little time left. I wish we had more time because I could talk to both of you for an hour more. I have so many more questions, but I want to know about the horses. There's these beautiful shots of the horses in the film with very little explanation. They relate to Katie and her story, but can you talk about the horses?
Yeah. Okay. The horses, I love to release the little behind the scenes fact that I filmed the horses. That's my cinematography. Wow. There was something that I knew we needed, and Patrick and I were having a difference of opinions on what to shoot at that moment. So I took a camera, I put it into slow-mo, and I walked out into the field and I filmed these horses. And then I put together this sequence in the edit. Katie loves to laugh at our little relationship fights. And Patrick was just mesmerized by it. So it's one of those things. It's one of those things where it's like we ourselves didn't even know what we were doing. We just knew that it had a purpose. We knew that it would be meaningful, and we knew that it was necessary. And over time, we came to discover the very thing that it is. You are there looking eye to eye inside this great beast of a creature, you know? And I mean, of course, horses are beautiful and they have huge hearts, but like essentially it's a massive animal and you're staring eye to eye with this. And that was very much like, for us, we felt like you see both, you know, the fury and the fear inside, like the grandness of this, but there's also something so innocent and almost fearful in each of those horses' eyes that you don't know if you should put yourself up on guard or if you should cower, you know, into like its neck and find connection with it. And that was just, in a way, again, another beautiful metaphor, symbolic of basically where Katie had to kind of give to what was coming through her and her art. She couldn't control it. She couldn't, you know, she couldn't try to be bigger than it. And if anything, if we sort of embrace that there is maybe something that's shared, that's vulnerable, and then we can allow something to come through that's very, very connecting, very honest, very human.
Erinisa Rumbish, thank you so much for being with us on the radio
today.
Thank
you, Mark.
Congratulations on the film. Thank you for making this film. It's so beautiful, and it really does touch you in so many parts, your brain, your heart, your soul. Katie Dalem, thank you for being with us on the radio today.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story and for being part of this film and opening up your life so generously for all of us to kind of look inside and see and see your strength and your beautiful art.
I have one last thing to say.
Please.
One thing the film did for me is that it made me realize that my story does have a purpose. You know, if it can help anybody else, that Erinessa and Patrick telling my story has made me accept myself more.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us today. Thank you, Katie Della.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having
hopefully
us.
We can have you